welcome to another catch-up episode of the podcast. I'm going to ask you how you are in a minute, so if you're on your own, feel free to answer in one word how you are. Ready? How are you? Wow! Of all the words you could have said, you said that word. Well, I hope you're well and have good cheer in these strange times. I'm good. Thanks for asking. I'm well. What's been happening? Well, lots of podcasts, as you will have maybe heard. And had my first new person with John Seed last podcast, No Research Uncut. Yeah, I think it went well. It actually turned out to be a bit longer than other episodes. If he'd just been in a normal in-between episode. So, yeah, I think that's the way we're probably going to go in the future. I got a bit tired, not talking to John, but just, you know, I realized that I've been doing a lot of podcasts. I think I was a bit like carried away with the, hey, these are so easy to do now, you know, without the editing, that I ended up, doing, you know, a lot. But yes, I'm finding my balance now, finding the way to go forward. Thanks for all the feedback. Lots of lovely messages and emails. I can't read them all out, but I'll read out two that I like. Well, one of them is just a nice message, and the other is a question. So let me see. Hang on a sec. Okay, this is an email I got about the last catch-up episode, which was the Bright Future catch-up. And I don't know if you've heard it, but it's the one where I was talking about consciously choosing which future you want to think about rather than being, you know, controlled by anxiety. So this person says, John, I just wanted to tell you how grateful I am for that wonderful podcast. I intended today to listen to one of your regular, in inverted commas, artist interview podcasts to try to motivate me to paint. I've been in a slump due to everything. Spending a lot of time dwelling on what next, what's going to happen. I loved your message, claiming sovereignty over one state. Thanks. So I got quite a few messages, similar kind of things. So it's very encouraging. You know, it's feedback. I go on about feedback quite a bit, but it really does make a difference to me to kind of know, yeah, I'm not just talking to myself here, or that what I'm talking about is of interest. Keep sending the messages. It's very encouraging, and it fleshes out your side of the conversation, because, you know, it's just me here talking, and in a normal conversation there'd be, you know, back and forth. So yeah, it's lovely to get the messages, so do keep sending them. And then this is the question one. The person says, hi John, hope you're well, just listen to your latest chat about your enlightenment quest and thinking positively. Awesome. I'd love to know the spark that initiated that awakening. So I thought about that, and I thought probably rather than me stumbling around trying to talk about enlightenment and all that and what it meant, the first chapter of my book, Maya Noise, is all about that, all about how it happened, what it meant to me and means to me and all that kind of thing. And, you know, I spent a lot of time articulating that and writing it out. So I thought, yeah, rather than just flopping around about it, I'll just read that. That'll be just easier. So let me just get that, and I'll read you the first chapter, the very first chapter of my book, Maya Noise. That's two words, Maya, which is a word for the illusion, and noise is noise, so Maya Noise. Yeah, not sure if it's a great name. I really like it, but, you know, if said quickly, it can sound like mayonnaise. But when you see it written, it's easier. Okay, so first chapter of Maya Noise, and it's called Off the Hook. That's the name of the chapter. I should warn you, it's a bit sweary, so if you don't like swearing, maybe don't listen, or be prepared, or if there's little young ears around that you don't want to hear swearing, maybe put the headphones on. It was an August night in 1996. I was sitting in a room in Dublin with 30 other people. We were there to share satsang with a woman called Catherine Ingram. Satsang is an Indian term and sounds much more exotic than let's get together and talk about spiritual stuff and maybe do a bit of meditation. No, satsang sounded much better, much more holy. We even took our shoes off. It wasn't the first time I'd seen Catherine. I'd been there the previous night, sitting down the back, grumbling to myself and feeling uncomfortable. I already had a spiritual master, and I wasn't looking for another one. I wasn't really interested in what she had to say, because unless it was close to what Barry Long was saying, I wasn't buying it. And besides, it felt kind of disloyal. Like supporting another football team just because they played football and happened to be in town. Yes, Barry was my spiritual master. He combined an Australian lack of pretension and just the right amount of thundering conviction to light up my Catholic feelings of inadequacy and guilt to perfection. Barry spoke with such certainty that it felt like he was channeling God. He may have even told us he was on occasion. Compared to Barry, Catherine was so wafty, so nice. She didn't make anyone wrong. She didn't arbitrarily descend on someone who asked a reasonable question and peel them emotionally like an artichoke while letting someone else who asked a moronic question go scot-free. She wasn't saying anything I could get my teeth into at all. Yet, I couldn't put my finger on it the previous night, but there was something about her. Something that bothered me enough to make me come back for a closer look. Literally, I sat at the front. Well, almost. One row from the front for safety. No point in losing my head completely. Catherine started talking and I started grumbling again. One thing was clear, it wasn't what she was saying that had brought me back. I would have tuned out completely but began to register something familiar about her. Not like I'd seen her somewhere before, I hadn't, but there was something about her that I recognised, a vibe, an energy. Then it hit me, Barry Long. She had exactly the same energy as Barry Long. I knew instantly she was enlightened. She didn't look or sound like Barry, and she didn't say the same kind of things Barry did, but her energy was exactly the same. I was gobsmacked. I wouldn't have been able to pick it up when I first came across Barry. Back then I didn't know anything about energy. I only knew he was enlightened because he told me. Barry told all comers he was enlightened. He delivered it like an Australian John Wayne. I'm enlightened and I'm a guru. Now what are you going to do about it? My response to this was, I'm going to stick as close to you as possible and hope some of it rubs off on me because I want to get enlightened like a lot. I didn't actually say this to Barry. I was too scared. I didn't want to get roasted in front of a room full of 300 people because that's what would have happened. Back then, the only way for me to talk to Barry or ask him a question was during one of his meetings. That's what we call them, meetings. No satsang bullshit for us. We were serious. I could have written him a letter, but chances are he would have read it out during a meeting as an example of someone who was unconscious, unholy, stupid, hiding something, or, well, you fill in the blank, and would have almost certainly finished with sexually frustrated, which in my case was true, but that's another story. Either way, I didn't want to look that desperate. In the search for enlightenment, it wasn't cool to look like you were searching, even though it was obvious that everyone who went to Barry's meetings were looking for enlightenment. At least that's the way it looked to me. In hindsight, it could have been just my perspective because enlightenment was a big deal for me. It started with Kung Fu. Not actually doing the martial art, but watching the TV show in the 70s. The one with David Carradine and his blind teacher, Master Po, who came across as very enlightened. He never got flustered or emotional, he could do amazing things with his body, and he had superhuman fighting skills. I was hooked. Being enlightened was cool. I didn't realize it at the time, but what was really drawing me was his lack of doubt. There were lots of other characters around at the time, like Batman or Captain Kirk, who were confident, but something about Master Po's lack of doubt went beyond confidence. Kung Fu gave me the idea of the master. When I got older, I discovered it wasn't just something on a TV show, it was a real thing. Cool. The first masters I read about were Zen masters. These guys sounded pretty much like Master Po. They were super wise, never got emotional, and some of them had cool fighting skills. The ones who didn't fight could do other cool stuff like archery. They always had students who were always looking for enlightenment. The stories nearly always followed the same pattern and nearly always made me feel divided. At the beginning of the story, the master would set the students an impossible task or riddle. At this point, I would identify with the student. I'd be right in there with them in their bafflement. What is the sound of one hand clapping? What the fuck? Then the master would return and in a single stroke illuminate the solution, which would always seem so obvious, so beautiful, so profound. Then I would identify with the master. Of course, it's so obvious. Why didn't they see that? If the story was really good, one of the disciples would get enlightened. It usually happened when the solution was being revealed. This part really interested me, because in that moment the student would become just like the master. I couldn't get enough of this stuff. It was like the spiritual equivalent of a superhero story, yet it was being advertised as attainable, even for me. In one radioactive spider bite moment, it was possible to go from being a spiritual pleb like me to being enlightened. No more doubt, no more pain. Except I didn't need to find a radioactive spider or come from a different planet to do it. All I had to do was figure out how these other guys, it was nearly always guys, got enlightened and do that. After Zen masters, I progressed to Indian masters and gurus. These were just as cool as the Zen masters, but with less fighting skills. Different masters had different approaches, but the process was always the same. The disciples were put through the ringer, and if they were lucky, eventually they would get enlightened. From then on, it was spiritual spandex. One disturbing pattern began to emerge. Most of the stories about spiritual seekers involved a period where they spent time in India, in inverted commas. This was a problem for me because I had no interest in India. The opposite, in fact. I knew people who had been to India. They all raved about the magic in the air and the colours and how everyone was so spiritual and the colours and how the energy was different and the colours. Like India had dibs on a whole other colour spectrum the rest of the world didn't know about. While they waxed lyrical, all I could hear was poverty, child prostitution, public defecation in the streets, crowded trains, and who cares about the fucking colours? I felt spiritually inadequate. Someone who was going to get enlightened should at least like the idea of going to India. Luckily, I never had to force myself to go because I came across Barry before I even got close. It was in a bookshop in Temple Bar in Dublin, not far from where I was now grumbling about Catherine. I'd been in this shop a few times before and had bought a couple of different books and tapes. That is one of the things you do on the spiritual path. You listen to cassette tapes to hear the master's voice. Okay, maybe not so modern now, but back then spirituality wasn't on CD yet and iPods hadn't even been thought of. I was up for listening to tapes if it meant I didn't have to go to India. I picked up a tape of Barry's called How to Stop Thinking. On the cover was Barry's stern face, complete with standard issue wise person grey hair and beard. I'd read enough to know that when it came to getting enlightened, thinking was bad, in inverted commas. It got in the way. So being able to stop thinking at will would be a handy skill. I brought the tape to the counter. The shop owner suggested it might be too intense for me. He wasn't trying reverse psychology. I got to know him later and it wasn't his thing. He actually took delight in seeing the look of confusion when he told someone not to buy something from his shop. For me, the effect was like telling a small boy the bike he wanted might be a little bit too big for him. I jumped on that hog and rode off down the street, feeling all grown up as I wobbled by. I inhaled the tape. Barry had the authority of a grumpy old schoolteacher who was good friends with God. He poo-pooed lots of the things I had suspected about the spiritual path but didn't have the balls to voice. In fact, the whole idea of a spiritual path seemed wrong to me. If enlightenment transcended space and time, surely the idea of a path was a bit linear. Barry's take? The spiritual path is bullshit. I was also suspicious of the way anything from India was given automatic spiritual credibility. Barry's take? Indian masters are bullshit. He did spend some time in Nepal when he was passing through death, as he called it. That was brought on by the love of his life dumping him. He spent most of his time in a bungalow and didn't interact with anyone while he was there, which sounded like standard behaviour when you got dumped by the love of your life to me. Barry's take?
Fuck you, I passed through death.
Either way, it didn't really qualify as having spent time in India on his spiritual resume. I devoured as many tapes and books of Barry's as I could. I went to his meetings, which consisted of Barry sitting on a stage telling us about the ultimate truth, how to get our lives right, and meditation. First a weekend in London, then a week in Leicester, then 3 weeks in Australia for an annual event called the Master Session, which was basically 3 weeks of meetings. Like many other spiritual masters, he called what he did his teaching, and it was our job to live it if we were serious. I, of course, was very serious. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me. I'd been trying to live Barry's teaching for about 5 years by the time I was sitting in front of Catherine, and by then I'd developed a nice sense of spiritual pride. I felt I knew something. It was mostly borrowed from Barry, but it was something nonetheless. That's why Catherine being enlightened was wrecking my head. Barry was such a monolith of certainty and power. I felt like insecure jelly in comparison. The thoughts of me being like him were at best years away. My hair wasn't even close to going grey yet, and beards were, well, itchy. But there it was, unmistakable. She had the same lack of doubt Barry had. By that stage, I knew enough about spiritual masters to know that even though their personalities might be different, that fundamental lack of doubt was the same. How the enlightened master expressed their enlightenment had a lot to do with what their personality was like. Catherine's personality couldn't have been more different to Barry's, yet the lack of doubt at her core was the same. I knew because I'd spent enough time around Barry to know what that looked and felt like up close. It was something beyond his personality. Ironically, it was most noticeable when he was quiet. I think it was because Catherine's personality was so different that it did the trick for me. In one instant, everything changed. I knew she was enlightened. I recognized her fundamental lack of doubt, and in recognizing it, the fundamental doubt in me disappeared. In the instant of knowing she was enlightened, I knew I was too. How that expressed itself in my personality was disbelief and terror. It was such a radical thought for me. Me, enlightened? Deep inside, I knew it was true, but my personality wasn't so sure. It was pretty sure I was wrong. So when it came time for questions, I found myself on my feet. No one else stood up when they asked questions. I obviously meant business. I looked Catherine squarely in the eye, sort of, and asked her if she was enlightened. I think I expected a Barry-like response. Of course I'm enlightened. What did you bloody expect? Instead, Catherine hedged. She said the term enlightened was very loaded and she didn't like to encourage people to get hung up on it. She said some more things too, but I'd stopped listening at that point. She'd said enough. My personality knew she was enlightened and from that moment on it conceded that I was too. I may have even interrupted her mid-sentence as I heard myself say, "If you're enlightened, then I am too." Catherine just smiled at me. She'd been smiling all night, so it wasn't a special enlightened smile. And that was it. Job done. I've been enlightened ever since. Of course, at the time, it was brand new, and I didn't know if it would last. Back then, I was afraid I was just tripping. This wasn't my first profound experience. Usually, the emotion and certainty faded in time. I didn't know what to do. It was all so unexpected. Should I tell people? Should I not? I tentatively broached the subject with the shopkeeper from the bookshop the next day. I'd gotten to know him well by now and thought he might be able to help. He didn't seem that fazed about it. Like, this sort of thing happened regularly. I started to think that maybe lots of people were enlightened and were just not saying anything about it. He encouraged me to just let the realization sit, to tell people if I really felt moved to, but otherwise, say nothing. I didn't have much time to think about this because not long after I got enlightened, my life was ripped apart. I was married at the time, and my wife and I lived in a little house with our cherished little girl. The rip came when I fell in love with another woman. It was deep and seismic, and though we never consummated our relationship, the searing intensity of the love brought about the end of my marriage and the relationship itself. Within 2 months, I'd lost my wife, my child, and the woman I'd fallen in love with. I wrote to Barry about becoming enlightened and the turmoil in my life that followed. The next master session was coming up, so I went to Australia for feedback. I wanted to see if my enlightenment and the events that followed would stand up to the scrutiny of my master. If I was kidding myself, Barry would see it. I went fully prepared for a public tongue-lashing. It never happened. He approached me at the end of one of the meetings and asked me how I was. I told him I was doing okay, all things considered. He said, "Well, you can't have a realization like that and not have things change." And then he smiled at me, and this time it was a special enlightened smile. I've known I was enlightened since that night with Catherine Ingram. Years ago now, and it has never changed, never faded or evaporated. It's part of my awareness, always there, clear beyond knowing. There, as soon as I become conscious, even before I remember my name or who I am. I was on the hook before I got enlightened. I was searching for something that would fix me. Something that would remove the fundamental flaw in me. Not that I would have admitted it. If asked, I would have said I liked myself. If pushed, I would have said I was perfect, just the way I was. I wanted to believe it, but in my heart, I didn't. In my heart of hearts, I believed there was a better, shinier version of me that I could be living and that I should be living and that if I got enlightened, I would be living. The problem was that at my core, I didn't trust myself to get there. I didn't think I had it in me. There were so many examples of people who were better all around me. I actually didn't know any of them because they were all in movies or on TV, but I didn't need to know them to know they were better. There was always Barry. I knew him, but then he was in a different league to me. He'd got there. He had the authority and followers and the books and the tapes and the women and the beard. Me, I lived in quiet fear my flaw would take me over. I was always looking over my shoulder on the inside, afraid of my own shadow. When I realized at the deepest level of my being that the fundamental flaw was an idea and not real, I became enlightened. I took myself off that hook and it disappeared from inside me. It was like waking up from a dream and realizing that I wasn't walking around naked in public after all. In one way, becoming enlightened didn't change anything for me. In another way, it changed everything. There was no rush of emotion, no instant zen-like calm, no new fighting skills. The main feeling I had at the beginning was, is that it? I knew I was enlightened, but it wasn't what I'd expected at all. This Zen saying summed it up. Before enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water. After enlightenment, chopping wood and carrying water. This was certainly the case for me. I was still chopping wood and carrying fucking water. I wasn't particularly happier, I didn't feel wiser, I still got angry and sad, I missed my daughter terribly, I still had financial difficulties, got myself into destructive relationships with women, and did I mention I'd no new fighting skills? I had doubts about lots of other things, but never the one at the core of my being. The hook never reappeared. Not even when I was suicidal years later. Suicidal? Not something I expected to be once I got enlightened, but there I was, holding the knife over my heart, ready for the final push. The remarkable thing was, in spite of the dark place and the intense emotional pain I was in, the hook was still absent. It never returned because I had no place for it inside. I'd lost the notion of some other perfect me that I should strive to become. I knew I'd continue to grow and change, but I knew the fundamental essence of who I was would be the constant in the change. Like a seed that used to give itself a hard time about not being an oak tree, I now knew I was a seed and a sapling and an oak tree all at the same time. A couple of months after I got enlightened, I was at a social gathering. In the center of the room, a group of people were listening to a woman regale them with stories of enlightened Indian gurus and their amazing feats. Being newly minted, my ears pricked up at the mention of enlightenment. She was telling the group that enlightened yogis had complete control over their bodies. They could bury their head in the ground for months or even years on end with no food or air and still remain alive. The group looked impressed. For me, it conjured up strange mental images of these men buried head down in the ground. I wanted to crack a joke about possible places to park your bike, but thought better of it. Part of me wanted to jump in and squeak, "Hey, that's me too. I'm enlightened as well. I know about this stuff." That was until the ridiculousness of what she was saying registered. What? Burying their heads in the dirt? What? This was not a silly woman, and these were not silly people who were listening to her. Yet all I could hear was mass disempowerment. Jim Jones couldn't have hoped for this level of complicity on his best day. With each grave nod of their heads, they were separating themselves from the possibility of ever getting enlightened. And for what? For some imagined enlightened superpowers? Burying your head in the dirt? Personally, I've never met anyone who could do any of the enlightenment tricks I'd read or heard about, but over the years, I've heard many intelligent people talking about enlightenment like it was something that only happened to special people, certainly not people like them. I went to see some Tibetan monks make a mandala once. I did it to try and ingratiate myself with the woman I had in my crosshairs at the time. It was all very reverent and serious, with explanations on boards and requests for silence. At the centre of the room, the monks were busy making the mandala, and it was a sight to behold. They moved like birds in flight, each monk knowing exactly his part in the unfolding pattern they were drawing with coloured sand. The craftsmanship involved was extraordinary. I could totally appreciate the spirit of the endeavour. 3 weeks of work by 5 or 6 monks to create this complex pattern, which was then ceremoniously chucked in the river. Right on, I totally got it. What was pissing me off was the faux benediction of all the people who were there to watch, most of whom were Irish and had probably rejected Catholicism, yet were now behaving like they were at Mass. And I'm not talking about the quiet, I'm talking about the cloying sense of deferred sanctity. Like being Tibetan meant the monks were automatically more holy. Please. Even though I was there with a long view on getting laid, the default reverence was getting the better of my libido. Thankfully, the monks helped me out. I was on the point of leaving my companion to Her Holiness when I noticed one of the monks had come to a dead stop. He was looking fixedly at his portion of the pattern. I knew that look. After a minute or so, he withdrew and approached one of the other monks. It wasn't long before a third had joined them. They were all focused on the spot in the pattern where the monk had stopped. I'd worked on enough building sites to recognize this kind of congregation. It meant only one thing, a fuck-up. They could have been looking down a manhole in Ballyfermot. I didn't understand what they were saying, but the dynamic was universal. The foreman eventually joined the group. He surveyed the damage, remonstrated the offending monk through smiling teeth, told him there was nothing to be done about it but to continue on, and with a sidelong glance at the circling audience, said that these Westerners would probably never notice the mistake anyway. The last bit could have been my projection, but I recognized the intent nonetheless. I looked around at the other bystanders. No one seemed to have noticed the little conflab. For me, it was a godsend. A little bit of humanity in the midst of all this piety. These men were, by Western standards, supposedly close to, if not already enlightened, and yet they were ordinary, just like me. They weren't burying their heads in the dirt, they were making a bit of traditional art and fucking it up just like I might. If people got a bit strange just talking about enlightenment, they got even stranger if I told them I was. The reaction was always mixed. For the ones that got it, it wasn't a big deal. For the ones who didn't, it was uncomfortable for both of us, like a fart in an elevator. They could hear what I was saying, but I didn't match their ideas of what an enlightened person should look and sound like. It didn't matter that it was said in a spirit of inclusion, some friendly encouragement to stop using the idea of enlightenment to put themselves down. The fact that I wasn't actually looking for validation was lost to the quiet judgment and distancing that followed. I understood the judgment. I'd been guilty of it myself. About 6 weeks after I got enlightened, a friend was going through a difficult spiritual awakening, and he was finding it tough. I recognized the kind of pain he was in and thought he could do it knowing he was enlightened. I told him about my experience with Catherine. He had the sort of reaction you'd expect if I told him I just bought a new car. He asked about performance and benefits. The word cool featured highly in the conversation, but it didn't seem to ease his pain at all. I was left scratching my head. A couple of weeks later, he took me aside and gravely told me he had become enlightened too. I didn't get it. He didn't have the same energy as Barry or Catherine, and his core doubt still seemed to be there. His declaration sounded more like a wish than his reality. I was squirming a bit on the inside, not really knowing what to say next, when I realized it was none of my business. Enlightenment is such a personal thing. I didn't know what hook he had just taken himself off on the inside, or if he even thought of it in those terms. There were plenty of spiritual masters who declared they were enlightened, and I didn't get it from them either, and so what? I realized it wasn't my place to judge. He was the only one it really mattered to. I came to the conclusion that telling people I was enlightened wasn't such a great idea. I've told less than 15 people in as many years. I'd resigned myself to the fact that getting enlightened was something that would only benefit me and my life. I didn't realize that events had been set in motion 3 years before I got enlightened that would put it to use in a very practical way and stretch me in ways I hadn't conceived. So there you go. That's the first chapter of Maya Noise, and that's my answer to that person's question. I hope it helps. A lot of spiritual books are about the lead up, and the last chapter would be like that, you know, when it all kind of came together. Maya Noise starts with that and then goes on from there. Okay, so be well. Be of good cheer, and I'll talk to you again soon.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle.